head of organized crime groups and cracked down on illicit activities, and that it was essential to maintaining the safety and security of our country. And that statement hasn't really changed either when you're looking at C-12 now. Alina, your thoughts on this rationale, and whose safety are we talking about?
Well, that is a great question. Whose safety are we talking about? And in this case, I can say with 100% certainty, it is not the safety of refugees and asylum seekers that we are talking about. And it is, of course, very, very disappointing. Honestly, in my opinion, I think that this justification is a misunderstanding on politicians' aspects, on their sides. There's a lot of rhetoric going around within parliament, within people who are decision makers, that people abuse the refugee system in order to extend their stay. This is not factual, really. Our numbers don't agree with this statement. Oftentimes, when politicians are speaking in the House about this bill, particularly about migrants coming with quote-unquote falsified documents, they're not understanding exactly what they're speaking about. They use this talking point to talk about refugees coming. And when they use an example of this, quote, abuse of the system, the examples that they're giving are international students who have unfortunately been swindled. It is not on their side that this is something that they have decided to do. There were unfortunately bad actors in Canada and in various countries of origin that were unfortunately falsifying certain kinds of documents for international students. I would like to just again reiterate that this is not the fault of the students themselves. This is the fault of bad actors within institutions. And so if that is actually the concern for this minister, you know, go after the Canadian bad actors that are enabling this to happen. Do not go after individuals. So I think that this justification largely comes from...
That was a small clip from this week's episode of the Courage My Friends series. To listen to the full interview, please visit our sister podcast, Needs No Introduction. Switching gears now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's turn things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with labor news. The BC General Employees Union have now been on strike for 7 weeks, making it the longest strike in the province's history. A sticking point between the union and the government has been wages, with the province offering a 5% increase over 2 years. The union countered that offer with a proposed increase of 8% over the same time period, but say that the government has not responded to their counteroffer. The number of provincial employees on strike expanded this week as 1,600 licensed professionals represented by the Professional Employees Association announced they would be heading to the picket lines. The Professional Employees Association has been in negotiations with the government since May, but, like the BC General Employees Union, talks have stalled over the matter of wages. BC Premier David Eby acknowledged that the strike has been going on for a long time, but defended his government's bargaining strategy, claiming that the wage increases that his negotiators have put on
the table mixtape is not were fair. Tune in to the Vancouver Mixtape for your own personal mix of Vancouver's best independent music, interviews, and more. Join me, Jesse, and my co-host Jamie on our trek through Vancouver's underground, Sunday nights at 8 o'clock on CJSF.
Against Canada were more about attacking our national sovereignty than being part of a should not let the colder weather freeze their hearts.
Hello,
to the point
and welcome
of the
to
unhoused.
HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wyland. In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Disability Consultant Trinity Bellwoods Park. So what can you tell me about your work as a disability
consultant? She says that she has seen people react with derision or disgust to the sight of people sleeping in doorways or public elevators to get away from the cold. Byers explains that often what goes unseen are the individual struggles that lead people to become unhoused. Things like addiction, mental health issues, or simply an inability to keep up with the rising cost of living and debt. She argues that it will be community and compassion that helps solve the housing crisis, not blind eyes and cold hearts. And finally, the Canadian Football League has announced changes to its rules. Carl Nirenberg argues, however, that instead of shortening the field and moving the goalposts, the league instead should be making rules that ensure the safety of its players. Particularly, Nirenberg notes how often quarterbacks get hit hard and then injured. Because of their value to the team, it is often to the opposing team's advantage to injure the quarterback.
So being a disability
at one point this season, the Montreal Alouettes were on their fourth quarterback after the previous three went out with injury. Nirenberg says that the game would be more fun and more Canadian if players were better protected.
In your work with churches,
and as always,
do you ever find
version of all the stories we talked about today,
Smith I've encountered a few times that just because a person with a disability is in the church means they're automatically included and accepted?
If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, that's
not great,
rate, is it?
Review,
I mean, I think,
share Rabble
I think
Radio
you don't have to
with
dig
your friends. It takes 2 seconds to support independent
case,
media
right?
like Rabble. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on Rabble.ca. And thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supporting
more
music. Lastly, thank you to you for tuning in to Rabble.
There's so many more aspects to belonging.
I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week.
And I think it plays out in just all kinds of little ways where someone feels seen or whether they can actually be in a space or whether someone's even thinking about them and their diverse needs. Just simply being a part of the church does not always equal belonging for people.
So, that being said, do you have any advice for folks out there who want to do the right thing, who want to be truly inclusive and not just make it an afterthought, check the box, what have you?
Yeah, I think there's a couple things. One thing is that I would just really encourage folks to not think about one-directional ministry. There's not people who give and people who receive. We all are interdependent, and we all have needs, and those are just different needs. And so anything that looks like ministry to doesn't feel real great. I think there needs to be a recognition that each person is essential to the body of Christ. And so everybody has gifts to offer, and so I think that is one really big kind of like way you look at it that is really important, because it sets you up for how you're going to approach things. We don't want to be kind of in a position of like, this person is needy and then I'm going to provide for them, because that's just not how it works. People with disabilities bless the community, and the community mutually blesses each other, right? And so the whole community misses out when people with disabilities aren't present.
So it kind of sounds like you touched on the tendency in some churches to want to fix a person with a disability, overlooking the fact that in some cases they might actually be happy as they are. They might even be productive as they are.
Absolutely. I mean, part of ableism is this assumption that we sometimes have about other people's lived experiences, like, oh, that poor person. And that may not be at all what the person experiences. That might just be the life that they've always lived, especially for folks who are born with disabilities. I think oftentimes it's not something that they're thinking of as a bad thing. It's just part of the body that they're in. And I think that's a really important point.
So, to look at the converse side of things, in your work with churches to promote the equality of persons with disabilities, Is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Yeah, I really think a lot of the success comes in small moments, small wins, small tweaks. And I think often we want to think really big. And when I talk to churches, they might talk to me about their not having an elevator, for example. And yes, we need elevators. If people cannot get into the sanctuary, that's a massive problem. And we need to do that. And also, there's so much more to the conversation than that. So we want to be thinking about all the tweaks that we can do. So I think of a church I was talking to, and they had a little girl with Prader-Willi syndrome. Now, if you don't know what Prader-Willi is, one of the aspects of it is sort of a inability to monitor food intake. So if there's food around, often someone with Prader-Willi will just eat it. And so that can be tough in a church environment where food is so much a part of our culture. And this particular church really kind of blew me away because they had decided to no longer offer cookies during the kind of coffee hour after church. And I can picture a lot of churches that I've been a part of that not offering cookies, like a change like that to your every week rhythm, would be quite controversial and people would be upset. But this church, it was almost like they didn't think anything of it. It was like, this doesn't work for this family. We value this family and we want them to be here. And so, of course, we'll get rid of cookies. So for me, like, there's just so many examples of ordinary choices that are done intentionally that really make a difference for that person or that family. And whether or not they can even be there sometimes, or just whether they feel like they're wanted in the space. I can think of lots of wins that are just churches thinking intentionally. And sometimes it's that responsive design around a particular individual, like this young girl. And often it's wins of just being thoughtful about continuing to offer online worship along with in-person worship post-COVID, right? We figured so much out that created a more accessible space for people with disabilities during COVID. And then a lot of times we just kind of reverted back. And anytime we can take what we've learned to create accessibility and continue to do that, that's a big win. So like in my church, worshippers who are online are not just there, like, viewing it. They're engaged. So we might have someone tell their testimony or their story through Zoom and be one of the speakers. Or when they do communion, they offer it to the camera and they say, Christ's body broken for you, Christ's blood shed for you, like looking at the camera so that person is engaged and included. So I think a lot of the successes come in just ordinary tweaks. The pastor who says, oh, I can raise the font on my PowerPoint slides every week. That's an easy win. I've done it one time and now it's done. And now things are more accessible going forward.
Like to thank you for taking the time out to do this. But if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
In this segment of our show, we'll hear from Kate from ACEPD. So if you could introduce yourself and tell me a little bit about the Action Committee, that'd be great.
Sure. So I'm Kate. I'm one of the advocates of the Action Committee for People with Disabilities. We've been active in the province of British Columbia for the last 50 years. We just recently celebrated our 50th anniversary. We're active assisting people with disabilities in the province, specifically Victoria, connecting individuals to services. So what we do is we help people fill out forms and they come to us for assistance if they're trying to navigate getting services or assistance with different things. We are not lawyers, but we do advocate with lawyers We have some lawyers in our sort of arsenal that we can call on if some of our clients need legal assistance.
So, what are some of the key barriers that the committee works to help people with disabilities navigate?
We help people to navigate, connection to services, but mainly we help people apply for or navigate the medical system, to get a doctor, to get medical equipment that they might need. We work with agencies, we work with partner agencies to connect them to being able to get those services or those pieces of equipment, whether they be free or otherwise.
So how do you reach out to folks with disabilities to let them know about your work?
We have a website that they can go to, actioncommittee.ca, and that outlines their services. They can also access a request for an advocate to get back to them at that website, and also they can reach us at area code 250-383-4105. We are we operate Monday through Friday, 9 to 4.
So, in your work, do you ever find that a person with a disability might not know all the benefits and services they're entitled to?
Quite often that's the case, especially if they are coming from a different province. Our experience is that they believe that their benefits carry over from province to province. That is not the case. You actually have to be in the province for a total of 3 months before you can apply for provincials. Benefits.
So, that being said, in your time with the committee, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
We, our agency has been successful in the last 50 years. Our founding president was instrumental in getting accessible transportation in the province of British Columbia. BC Transit now has a fleet of accessible buses, whereas before people with disabilities in Victoria particularly, and across the province quite frankly, were limited to specialized handy art services or such services. So right now, because of Joanne Neubauer's work, they can people with disabilities can access accessible transportation. Meaning, we have low floor buses is what I'm referring to. Low floor buses where ramps come out, and people with wheelchairs can board that way. Joanne was also instrumental in getting accessible airline seats, basically, for people with disabilities and people who need to travel with them, so their attendants. So what she ended up being able to do with other people at the Action Committee and with partnership in the province, she was able to connect with Transport Canada and make it so that people with disabilities could travel half price, or the person that traveled with them could travel for a reduced fare. So that was pretty impressive. Before that, we all had to pay full fare for our attendance, and or we weren't able to travel at all because the airlines and the airports weren't able to meet the needs of people with disabilities.
So Do you know offhand when these initiatives were implemented?
Well, we were founded in 1975, so we have been... or are you talking about the transportation initiatives?
I'd like to thank you for taking the time out to do this, but if you can stay on the line for a sec, that'd be great.
Sure.
Handy Link will be right back after these commercial messages, so stay tuned.
I am proud of my promotion.
Needs more shoes.
I earned it.
And business suits.
It is a big deal for our family.
Renovators.
I like the people I'll be working with.
Restaurants.
I still need a lot before I get started.
Carly's, hair salon, and luggage.
I know our kids are so proud of me.
Jewelry engraver.
It was my idea to put our company on the radio.
Promotion deserved. Be where anyone who needs you can meet you. Be on the radio. Your customers are already here.
Welcome back to HandyLink. I'm your host, Cam Wells. Earlier in our show, we heard from ACPD advocate Kate, and Lindsay Whalen-Capel told us a little bit about her disability consulting work. This interview is a post-dated one, so some of the events referred to may already have happened. In this segment of our show, Meredith Patterson will be telling us a little bit about NCICAP. So what can you tell me about the Captioning Institute?
Well, where to begin? We have 45 years of history that I could go through, so I guess it depends what you want to know. I'm the president and chief operating officer at NCI. I have been with NCI since 2003. I was actually hired as an offline editor, which means I used to watch TV as my job and add the captions for pre-recorded programming. And I have worked my way up in the company and now am holding that position where I'm strategically determining the future of NCI, and I've witnessed a lot of changes in my 23 plus years in the company because of how much the technology has changed and how much we have changed the technology. So what would you like to know about what we do? We are a nonprofit. We are a mission-oriented organization, which I've always found to be particularly poignant and also sort of fascinating because we have competitors and not a lot of nonprofits necessarily are competing in the way that we do for business, but it's our mission to provide access to communications wherever and however we can so that the deaf and hard of hearing communities and also anyone who might be learning English or is interested in learning a foreign language, we also do a lot of translation,
so
is able to do so.
So I'm curious, you mentioned changes to the process of captioning over the years. Can you give me an example of how things might have improved since you began?
Sure. Well, historically, it was trained court reporters who were using stenographic shorthand to produce the captioning. And that was the case for many decades, but that's something that you have to be trained on because it's literally like learning another language. You don't use a QWERTY keyboard. You use a special steno machine. And that stenographic shorthand is really like another language. So for a long time, that was how captions are produced, and some captions today are still produced in the same manner. We still have steno captioners on staff, but with the explosion of programming, there became a point in the early 2000s where it was apparent that the volume of programming was quickly outpacing the number of people available to produce the captioning. There weren't enough people to do the work. So when I was hired, I actually shortly thereafter began experimenting with speaker recognition, where it's dependent on the person's speech, and I would train the computer to my voice in particular and try to get it to hear everything that I was saying accurately enough to produce the text of every word that I repeated into my microphone. So that was the birth of what we call voice writing, which I know is a fun term. It's, other people might call it re-speaking. But basically, we knew that we needed a way to caption more programming in a different manner, and the speech recognition technology was improving to the point where we could train articulate and people who are really good at multitasking to do this job and repeat everything that they hear on a broadcast into their computer system in order to generate the captioning. And that was a way for us to fulfill our mission and be able to caption more programming. So in addition to the steno captioners, we started hiring and training voice writers. And you would even have to add in the punctuation. You can mix in, you know, some use of the keyboard, but essentially it's all verbal. And you really had to work with the software to get it to understand you in the right way and make sure that it's producing what you want it to be producing.
So,
and that was your captioning.
So I'd imagine there's something of a challenge in keeping pace with everything that's said and making sure the distinction between words is properly recognized, such as your versus your.
Exactly. And we came up with a lot of different tricks in order to force the software to choose the correct version of the word. The interesting thing about voice writing is that it struggled the most with those small words, such as and instead of in, or like you said, you know, your or to, you know, which version was it, T-O or T-W-O or T-O-O. So we actually can train the system to, if it doesn't understand itself based on context, which of those selections is accurate, we could come up with verbal shortcuts or macros. And one of the ones that we like to share with people is that instead of saying the word in, I-N, we would say inly, and we are therefore telling the system every time I say inly, I'm saying in, and that way it doesn't misunderstand us and use the word and instead. So a lot of times we would be speaking what might sound to a passerby like gibberish, because we're working a lot of verbal cues into it. And that does require a lot of mental concentration and the ability to really think very quickly on your feet. And instead of hearing and repeating the word in, saying something like inly. Another example people have enjoyed hearing over the years is I determined it was way too much to say question mark. That's too many syllables in order to produce one simple little piece of punctuation. So every time there was a need for me to insert a question mark, I would say poof. And I would just train the system so that it knew anytime I said the word poof, it would produce the question mark symbol. So there were a lot of different ways to work with the software in that way to force it to produce what you wanted it to, but it's very much an effort in multitasking, and you are literally doing many things at once. You're also watching your captions on the screen, you're listening, you're talking, you're adding in the punctuation. So we developed a whole methodology and training program around that.
So in your time doing this work, is there any success moment or story that stands out for you you'd like to share?
Oh, well, that's a great question. I think there have been many different successes over the years. personally, I think it's, I've heard from a lot of people just being involved in a very intimate way in breaking news and major world events.